My favorite definition of a professor is someone who speaks in other people's sleep, so feel free. That's Auden, not me. Those six topics were the ones that I realized were my problem. Like many of you, I suspect. How many of you grew up in Christian homes? Almost everyone, you see. We're not doing a great job at outreach at that level. We are loved into the church, aren't we, rather than talked into it. And I grew up in a blue-collar environment in Birmingham, the British equivalent of Detroit. The street that I grew up in 40 years, three boys went to university from 400 houses. Only one of them turned out to be a doctor. And yet, 40 years later, my father told me on the telephone, when I told him we were going to Africa for the first time, he said, "John, I have waited 47 years to hear you say that." And then he told me that the proximate cause of my mother's conversion, my mother grew up in a Marxist home, my grandfather on that side was a Marxist trade union leader, and that was the environment in which she'd grown up. And she left school age 12 because my grandfather didn't believe in academics anyway. She was asked to go. She was given a scholarship, but he wouldn't let her take it. And so she was earning a living as a seamstress, which was way beneath her abilities, except that she made all her own clothes and she didn't need anything so mundane as a pattern. She was working next to a Christian woman who was smart enough not to evangelize. I mean, when you're going to be working with someone, you're going to evangelize whether you like it or not, and it's what you do that counts, not what you say. And when she'd earned her brownie points, she said to this teenager who was not happy, "We've got some interesting missionaries in our church this week. Would you like to come and listen?" Now, these were missionaries who'd gone to the Congo with C.T. Studd. Some of you may remember that name. WEC, the organization he founded, never gave a salary. So if you joined WEC, it was because the Lord had told you to join WEC. They'd test to see that that was not an illusion on your part and then give you some training, and off you went, and you had to pray for everything. And of course, this was a long way from Marxism. And God had never, ever let them down. And they'd been in some pretty hairy situations. So she went back three nights in a row and got saved. Now she had someone to write to. So she started writing. And in those days, the mail got to the Ituri forest. It doesn't anymore, but it did then. So they knew when she got engaged, when she got married, and when I was conceived. And what my father told me 47 years later, my mother died a year or two before that, he said, once they heard that you were conceived, they prayed for you every day until they died. And they prayed that I would become a Christian, that I would become a doctor, and that I would go to the Belgian Congo. The sort of experience when you hear that on the other end of the line, it sends tingles down your spine or up your spine, whichever way they go. Amazing. But that's God. That's who it is. So I grew up in that environment, and my mother was a brilliant teacher. I didn't know that. I mean, she had no formal education. I thought she just did what every mom did. I learned as the years went by that wasn't true. She taught Sunday school for 35 years without a break, except for a summer holiday, on her own. Anywhere between 30 and 50 children aged 5 to 12 in a single room. Never had any discipline problems because she did two things. She could teach them to sing, and she could sing, and she could tell the Bible stories and bring them to life. And that's what she did. She knew she'd got an odd little boy on her hands, so she taught me to read very early, and she thought I should learn a paragraph every Sunday, not a verse. And am I glad for that now? There's chunks of scripture that will come into my mind that I haven't read for years, you know, and suddenly they'll arrive. What we put into children's minds early on really matters. Those first 7 years are critical. And I had all the stories of the Bible put there, which is what should happen. That's important. But the follow-up is important, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So I went off to university and turned out I was only fit to be an academic, so I didn't leave an academic environment, except when I went on trips to Africa, but that had academic connections initially. It didn't look as though the last one would happen, but it did. That's the way God works, and even that was ironic in that when we got to Canada, we lived in Jamaica for 7 years, I was supposed to have a job in London, and Mrs. Thatcher cancelled the funding as her first act of government. So I'm actually a refugee from Mrs. Thatcher. I'm very grateful, because Canada's been a wonderful place to bring up our family in many ways. So we arrived in Ottawa, and we couldn't find a church we liked. We were rather addicted to proper sermons. I mean, when I was a medical student, I used to listen to Martin Lloyd-Jones once or twice or sometimes three times a week. Nothing like that was available. The backup was John Stott. I mean, we're kind of spoiled. So we joined a little church opposite us because they believed the Bible was true and that you needed to get saved, so that was a start. And I won't name the church, but I call them the most loving and most ignorant people I'd ever been with in my life as Christians. They would sit under a picture of John Wesley and say, "Become a Christian now. How historically ignorant can you be?" But that's what happened. But some missionaries came, and they, of course, were from the Belgian Congo. And my wife, being hospitable, brought them to our house. And they discovered that I knew at that point as much as anyone in the world about the treatment of severe malnutrition, because I'd just spent 7 years with two other guys developing what are the standard protocols for the treatment of 10-pound two-year-olds, still in use today and will be forever. That's an amazing experience to have had. And they said, "Well, we've got a huge problem. You have to come and help us." And I asked them how big, and I said, "Well, you're not making the measurements properly. Nobody has a problem that big." And they said, "Well, come and help us." They neglected to note that the tribe they were looking after had intermarried with pygmies, so you need to change the standards a bit. But so that was sorted out. The actual prevalence was the expected 10%. But I'd been watching and seeing that the work that we'd done in Jamaica had not translated into Africa, and it hasn't translated till this day. But that's another story that takes an hour. I have to leave that hanging there. But God was at work in that too, as he pushed me back yet again to thinking about how early childhood education works. And we don't do it well at all. The bottom line for me came out of a series of lectures given in Ottawa by a man called Bruce Walke. Have any of you come across Bruce Walke? He's an academic, but yeah, he's an extraordinary man. Probably America's best Old Testament scholar in many ways. And he gave a series of lectures in Ottawa on covenant. And I really found them absolutely fascinating, particularly a throwaway line in the middle of it, which he said, "If you ask an Orthodox Jew why the Jews succeed," I mean, the Jews win the hard Nobel Prizes every year, don't they? At least half of them. Muslims haven't won one for 20 years. That tells you a lot about culture. And they will say, "Well, you need to go to Deuteronomy 6. Of course, I didn't know what Deuteronomy 6 was, but when I got there, I did. I just didn't have chapter and verse. It's the Shema. But it's what comes after it. It's, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your strength." Raise your hand if you can complete the verse. Nobody. There's sort of hands doing this, you know. You know there's a trick in it. So get it wrong in public and you'll never forget the right answer again. It's the way to get it right permanently. Anybody willing to volunteer the next bit of the verse? The first part. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your strength." Thank you. He says, "And your neighbor as yourself." That's wrong. That's in Leviticus. Normally, Christ uses Deuteronomy, but on that occasion in the New Testament, he's actually quoting Leviticus. Of course, yes. But even that is incomplete. There's something before you get to teaching it to your children. What's that? Hmm? I can't hear. Can you put it in a lower? Not you, the guy in front of you who's got a lower voice. Yeah, they must be upon your heart before you can teach them diligently. So teaching them diligently without them being upon your heart doesn't work, which is why the Faculty of Education is a disaster. Because they've got a basic premise wrong. They think that teaching is a skill that can be taught to someone else. It's not. Teaching is the conjunction of two loves. You must love the pupil, you must love the subject. And students know that. They will forgive you anything if you have those two passions. So I, as you can imagine, am totally politically incorrect. Nobody has ever gone after me beyond the class, because they say to the class, and it's the liberal students who say, he gave you every opportunity to express your point of view and you said nothing, you can't go after him. He didn't pretend. The thing they can't understand is professors who claim to be politically incorrect. You can't keep it up for a year. If you're lying, it will show. Whereas if you speak the truth, you can always, the great thing about the truth is you can speak it consistently. You can't lie consistently, that's why lawyers succeed. That's how they do it. So I now had something to think about. I began to understand why I hated the Faculty of Education, because I hold them responsible for destroying learning. Most of the young people here have gone through what I call a memorize and dump program. I didn't do that. When I went to medical school, they didn't care whether I was there, first of all, but there were only two exams, one at 18 months when they threw 40% out, and finals, which you were ultimately going to get through, because you'd only be referred, you wouldn't be actually thrown out at that stage. And I was in the top half of the class, so I didn't bother about the first, and the latter came along in due course. But real learning was going on, because you weren't memorizing and dumping. I remember a great teacher I had right at the beginning of, we had those first 18 months of ridiculous nonsense, and then we got to medicine. Nobody remembers their biochemistry. I had to teach biochemistry to medical students for years. And I would tell them, look, this is a total exercise in farce designed by the educationalists in our midst. You will not remember anything of this course. You possibly will remember the Krebs cycle. That might be an exception. That, of course, is of no value whatsoever, because you will never, ever meet a patient without a Krebs cycle. No Krebs cycle, you're dead. I did metabolic medicine, and somebody would turn up and you knew this was a metabolic disease, and then you got 6 weeks' work to find out what it was, because the only metabolic defects that are compatible with life are very small print. And it takes a long while to sort them out. You end up sending liver biopsies halfway around the world sometimes to get the answer you want. That's the way it works. So teaching biochemistry to medical students, the only way they can handle it is memorize and dump. And they forget it. There's a doctor sitting in the front row. If I tested him on his biochemistry, a postcard would be more than enough. Right? Of course. True of me as well. You have knowledge of it and you know where to go and look it up, but the details are details. If you use them enough, they get sewn in. So I began to understand what education was about. The next thing that happened in that process was, I'm not sure about the chronology at this point, but an important point that happened about that time was I was, as part of my duties as a professor, invigilating a Christmas exam. And about 10 minutes into the exam, I was given a note by the staff saying there was a bomb scare. And you have to take them seriously. So I said, it's almost certainly a hoax, but the university's been told there's a bomb around, and so leave your exam paper on the desk, pick up your bags and coats, and go for a 20-minute walk. It'll take security that long to find that there is no bomb. I went for a walk too. I got to the far end of the parking lot, and there were a group of students gathered around the back of an open pickup saying, and one of them said to the others, "You idiot, you were supposed to remember the third question." It was obvious who was responsible for the scare. And I thought, they did leave in a very orderly fashion. Perhaps they all knew about this. Perhaps my students knew about it. And I would never have caught them. So I was determined they were not going to get into medical school by cheating, so what could I do? And I ended up developing a fourth-year honors course in biochemistry that had no requirement for memorization, zero. The exam did last 8 hours. And it required you to read a paper and then say what it said and what it meant and what it implied and how you would go about it. That's a test of whether you can think. And I taught them to think during the year by doing the only way. Critical thinking courses are a rip-off. Don't ever take them. They're a waste of time. You might learn a few party tricks and that's it. But what you can do is show students, this is a very good paper, this is a bad paper, this is a moderate paper, in my view, and then give the reasons why you think that is so. And you can teach them how to take a text to pieces and begin to think about it. An exercise that doesn't happen in America very much is called précis writing. When I went to school, I wrote précis in 3 different languages in my high school. That's the way to understand a text, and you can come and talk to me afterwards or ask in question period. We do a bit of that at Augustine College too. It's the medieval way of learning. When you went for a master's degree in medieval times, they didn't want to know what you thought. I mean, you weren't old enough to have thoughts that were worth taking notice of. What they wanted to know is whether you knew how to think, and you did that by taking texts that were known to be good and rewriting them yourself so that they could read what you'd written to see whether you've understood the text. That's a real test. So with that background going on in my mind, you can imagine that I wasn't the most popular teacher. Well, that was untrue at one level, but I certainly walked in, gave my lecture, and walked out and didn't care whether they understood or not for quite a while. And I haven't got time to tell the whole story, but bit by bit, the pressure mounted. And then eventually, 6 of us were brought together by Providence via something God had done to me with the Sermon on the Mount. And we started having lunch together in the university. Quite a spectacular little group. We didn't know that we were all in the same university. But we had John Paul's canon lawyer, Pope John Paul, that is, smart man. Every time there was a canon law problem, he was off to Rome to talk to the Pope. David Jeffrey, who I think is the best evangelical intellect on the continent, now emeritus at Baylor. When he went to Princeton, they said, do you want to do your PhD in physics or medieval English? And he chose medieval English, could have done either. Speaks 9 languages. Enough said. We had Edith Humphrey, who's very much in demand around America at the moment. She's a very brave woman. Grew up in the Salvation Army, now joined the Orthodox Church, but teaches at the Presbyterian Seminary in Pittsburgh. A superb scholar. Graham Hunter, our philosopher, who was on the editorial board of Touchstone, now also retired, writing superb books. He's recently published a biography of Pascal. We had Ed Blado, who spent 20 years excavating in Asia Minor. You go there, he's never seen a column he doesn't want to admire. You know, it's an exhausting tour to go around Asia Minor with him. We did it on the steps of St. Paul. I was the only idiot in the group who didn't speak 5 languages, or everybody else did. So we were all fed up with the university, watching it decay. I mean, standards have been dropping steadily throughout our lifetime. I mean, when my arts colleagues were in graduate school, to get into a master's degree in Canada, you needed to be fluent in 3 languages, a classical one, a modern one, and English. Now you just need English to go to graduate school in the English department. Not surprisingly, the standards have dropped. Of course, we also take a large number of students into university who shouldn't be there in the first place. We're basically holding our nose and taking their money. That's why it's very good to miss first year, because we will have smartened up a bit at the end of the first year by having enough conscience to throw them out at the end of year one rather than taking their money for 3 years. When I went to university, less than 5% of students in Britain went to university. Well, just think what your class would be like if you'd got rid of 3/4 of it. It was a different world, an entirely different world. But it was an academic world. I didn't realize that. That's where we're going next. So none of us knew what to do. We'd all watched young people come from Christian backgrounds with a faith and depart 4 years later without one, in any active sense. And we didn't know what to do. Going to Bible school actually made it worse, because you might as well come with a target on your chest saying, shoot me, I'm a Christian, because they quoted scripture in such naive fashions that they just made themselves a target. Not surprisingly, they withered under the fire of much more intelligent and nasty people. You can now quote scripture in university again, you know, as long as you don't tell them that you're quoting it, and you paraphrase it so that they can't use Google. And they will recognize that I've said something that's far too smart for me to have said it, and somebody will even say, that's a quotation, isn't it? I say, well done, yes it is. Who do you think wrote it? And they usually say Socrates or Plato. And I say, well, it was a smart guy, but not that one. And I don't tell them who it was. Then they have to take it at face value, and they won't find out till I'm long since gone from there, so it doesn't matter. But you've got to learn to paraphrase. It's a test of whether you know. Memorization is not a test of knowledge, it's a test of memorization. When you've memorized a chunk of scripture, now put down your memory, so to speak, and see if you can talk your way through the passage. That's the test of knowledge. That's important. And when you can talk your way through, the next test is to get to wisdom. That's even harder. T.S. Eliot saw this coming years ago in Choruses from the Rock. He wrote, where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we've lost in information? Most deans pride themselves on running information-rich environments. Eliot would have said, yeah, that's exactly what you're doing, and what a disaster that is. Because the problem is not information that's freely available. The question is whether the information you've got is to be believed or not. And if you trust Wikipedia, you're very naive. It'll do as a start because it's for free and it's quick, but don't stick with that. Find some better standards than that. Change your reading habits. Raise them up a notch or two. So that situation was what we faced. And we didn't, frankly, know what to do. So we decided, we didn't start the college at that point. We decided, well, we would like to help. Maybe we should have our own reading group. So we started our own reading group. And for 5 years, we read every, I can't remember whether it was Tuesday or Thursday, but we had breakfast in a Greasy Spoon restaurant near the university, and they let us have a back corner to ourselves, and we read everything we could find on the nature of education from the Greeks to Alistair MacIntyre in the 20th century. We had upwards of 20, usually somewhere between 20 and 30 people coming within a year. No paper trail, no advertising. Graduate students, people from Parliament Hill, which is just down the road, from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation even. All sorts of people turned up. We counted, I think it was 19 languages around the table on one occasion. We always had all the ancient languages, including Aramaic. So it was the best seminar I ever attended in my life, I think, without any question. A five-year seminar on the nature of education, essentially. And we knew what the problem was. The problem is that we are now ahistorical. We have no history that we know. That's the big difference when you go to an African village, for instance. There is a storyteller whose job it is to know the village story, and that will take it back perhaps four generations. No paper, it won't go any further than that. You need more than that. And we are biblically illiterate. That's a major problem. That's why there's an interest in liturgy. Liturgy is a lazy man's approach to avoid reading the Bible. That's what it's being used for, and that's not bad. I mean, when you've got to the stage of not knowing the Bible, you better have a liturgy, and it better be a bit more rich than praise songs. That's the way it works. But it's not a success in one sense. It's a failure. I mean, you need both. Go to the Psalms. We don't even read the Psalms sufficiently. I think it's wise to read a psalm every day, because the way the Psalms work is when you go through a bad patch in your faith, as all people in medicine pretty well do, the last bit of the Bible you stop reading is the Psalms, because there are some very sad psalms. There are psalms for very bad days, at least six of them that begin in gloom and end in gloom. So at least you can't be so navel-gazing as saying, poor me. Obviously, there were at least six people who were in the same place before, and they came out the other end. There's no reason why you shouldn't. The dark night of the soul is a training program that we should be familiar with. You don't go through it if you're no threat to Satan. He's not going to disturb you if you're no threat to his kingdom. But if you are, you're going to be toughened up. That's obviously the way it works. So homeschooling mums and dads got on our case and graduate students. And we knew that what was needed was a History of Ideas program. And so that's how we started. We didn't want to do it. We didn't volunteer. When they said, you should do it, we said, well, we'll never get it through the university. The feminists would not allow a course in the History of Ideas for one very simple reason. If you ask the question, who are the 200 most important thinkers in the history of the world? Usually there'll only be two women are named, Hildegard of Bingen and Madame Curie. There are one or two others who should be there, but the feminists don't even know their names. All the rest are men. The reason for that is very simple. Women are smarter than men in a very practical way. They look around and say, what's the probability of this being useful? And if you think you're going to make a contribution to the history of ideas, you haven't got near any such practical thought, because the probability of you making a contribution is considerably less than that of winning the lottery. We only need about 200 names, and we've got most of what we need to this day in what's approaching 5,000 years of written history. And of course, the people who did make a contribution, you wouldn't want to be married to. Nobody would want to be married to Newton. Maybe Faraday, he was a nice man, but many of them were not. Impossible to live with would be my way of describing many of them. So God makes a few. And of course, both men and women have the same mean IQ, but the curve is very different. Women's looks like that. Quite narrow, quite steep, with a mean, as you would expect, at 100. Men's look like this. They've got bumps on both ends, so we have real idiots, but we also have the odd genius. And a very much flatter curve. God obviously made us differently. The male is the simpler animal, and women just don't realize that enough. We are so simple that we will get up and put the same clothes on as yesterday, drive the same way to work, come back the same way, eat yesterday's food warmed up and say thank you, as long as you just provide us with a few basic needs. And very simple, easy to run, totally predictable. We have only one hormone, and it's a straight line. Whereas women, their hormones for emotion look like the Rocky Mountains, so you don't know what you're going to feel like in the morning until you've woken up. Smart men work this out. They come home with flowers, and they've done nothing wrong. It's just the time of month when that's a good thing to do. Only idiots could maintain there's no difference between male and female. They certainly haven't raised children, have they? We had three daughters and then a son. What was the first thing he did? He went through every toy in the house to find everything with wheels on it. We're different, and thank God we are. He knew what he was doing. So they knew what our Achilles heel was. The one thing that academics like is the sound of their own voice. So these homeschooling mums and dads and graduate students said, would three of you do a Saturday evening talk? Three of you, say, doing half an hour each, and about what an education would look like if it was going to help you through university. And of course we said yes. When we'd finished, they said, well, when are you going to start? And we said, we're not going to, because we'd have to do it outside the university, and between us we don't have the administrative skills to run a hot dog stand, so sorry, it's not on. And then an accountant, a lawyer and a doctor said, we'll look after the practicalities if you'll do it. And we said, all right, but if we go into the red, we close. We thought 2 years at the most. Here we are 20 years later, which is the amazing bit. And every time we approach, I know what's going to happen now, every time we approach bankruptcy, and you couldn't write a business plan for what we do. It's not possible, because inputs come from places you don't expect. People come from places you don't expect. Accidents of mistaken identity, all sorts of things have played into the history of the college. But every time we've approached this bankruptcy thing, we say our prayers, and the first time it happened, a week or so later, a guy called and said, how's your college doing? And I said, pedagogically, it's wonderful. In terms of the economy, we're probably going to go bankrupt this summer. And he said, would $20,000 help? I said, who are you and why are you giving me $20,000? It would certainly help. And he laughed and he said, well, my favorite aunt has just died and I'm her executor. And I remembered the lady he was talking about. And he said, one of the last things she said to me was, I meant to give some money to a young man in Ottawa. I like that phrase. I like what they're trying to do. Find out if they need help, and if they do, give them what they need. There's plenty left over, she said, for that purpose. She came from a very wealthy family, and she'd been supportive in the past, but just at the right moment. The next time it happened, I was reprimanded on that occasion for not telling people enough, but the next time it happened, students knew very quickly, and I started getting checks from students who were still in school and accumulating debt for $100. That meant more to me than $10,000 from somebody who'd got money in the bank. But also, at the end, we got through that one. I got some angry emails from docs, because we run a program for docs in the summer. They said, how dare you think of closing without telling us? Don't you ever do that again. So I know we're not going to go bankrupt again. After a few years, you will have an alumni group that will not allow that to happen, because it changes their lives. Hopefully, I hope that Jenny would be here, but she's now at Johns Hopkins, but she's going to Skype in for those of you who want to get a first-hand account from somebody who's been through the program. And Ross, who's sitting at the back there, that you wave your hand so they know who you are. He runs the American Friends of Augustine College with three or four other physicians. His daughter took the course. Did she tell you I had lunch with her a few weeks ago? Yeah, in Ann Arbor. It is an amazing experience for me now. I can't go anywhere on this continent without somebody coming along and saying, oh yes, we know about you. It's an extraordinary experience, what the network is like. We are incredibly connected. When I first read about this stuff about everybody being connected by seven handshakes, I didn't believe that. And I happened to be at a conference and I said, well, let's try the Pope and George Bush, who was president at the time. By the end of the day, I realized I only needed two handshakes to get to the Pope. And I was talking to a physician from Texas, Joe McElhaney, and he said, well, you only need one handshake to get to George Bush. I went to school with him. That means you're one, or at the most two handshakes away from that connection too, because of the people I know here. And the Christian world is like that. We are incredibly connected. We just don't realize how much, and we don't celebrate it enough. So one of the things you need to start doing more of, you're much the best country in the world for hospitality and generosity, but do even better. We would not have had a gathering like this when we started in Ottawa. You're good at joining, not so good at putting the roots down as deep as they could go. That's the bit that needs some work on it. But your generosity is wonderful, just to make you feel a bit better about America. One of the most beautiful things that's happened in our life is the first time I did a conference on my own in the States, and God had eventually got me off my backside in academe to start doing what I do now, was at the Billy Graham Center. And on Saturday night, I was having supper with Sally, was with me on that occasion, with a couple who'd been missionaries, actually set up the ophthalmology program for Madagascar, which still runs to this day. And the lady of the family was a very direct American woman. And she said, I really enjoy the way you teach. I've never heard anybody in these sorts of conferences quote poetry, for instance, like you do every now and again. And it turned out she loved poetry, and so did I. I introduced her a few poets she didn't know about, and vice versa. And then she said, where were you teaching last? And I think it was the Ukraine, if I remember rightly. And she said, who paid for that? Americans do this straight to the point, you know. And I said, well, not me. I'm a professor and I have four children, some of whom are still in university. A Canadian physician paid the bill. And she said, does that mean you have invitations to Africa and Eastern Europe and places like that? And you say, no, because you don't have the money? I said, I don't say no, but I say I don't have the money. And they said no more. 2 weeks later, I got an email from David Stevens, the director of CMDA, and he said, I'm directed to tell you that an American couple have put $6,000 in an account at CMDA for you, and they've challenged CMDA members, and they will match it dollar for dollar for another six. And you are not to refuse invitations to Africa and Eastern Europe for lack of travel funds, or Asia. And you should take your wife with you, because you ought not to go on your own. I call it my widow's cruise of oil. Every time I get an invitation, I work out what we can afford. Then I call Barbara Snap and say, is there enough money in the fund? There always is. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was going to Bristol, the headquarters of CMDA, for a conference, and I happened to see the list, which I don't normally see, of people who'd signed up, and it included the couple we'd worked out had started this program. So I said to Sally, we ought to do some rough calculations of how much we've taken out of that fund. So we did. When I got there, I managed to sit down to have coffee with them. I said, we know you started our travel fund. Have a guess how much money we've taken out of it. And they guessed 30,000. And I said, nowhere near. It's over 100. They were so delighted. But the really important point is I have no idea who the other contributors are. That's America at its best. That's charity done in a very good way. And something to be proud of as a culture. Proud in the sense of grateful to God, because it's only because of God that this is so. Your history matters. If you've got anybody in business, get them Robert Fogel's book, The Fourth Great Awakening. A secular Nobel Prize winner in economics from the University of Chicago who understood this. I had the great privilege of meeting him a few years ago. He died 2 years ago. And I ended up doing grand rounds at the University of Chicago, well past my sell-by date as a trendy scientist. So they asked me whether I wanted to meet anyone while I was there, and I said I'd like to meet Robert Fogel, and they arranged that. Because a book called The Fourth Great Awakening, written by a secularist, is a bit surprising. And what was more surprising was he was looking at his economics class in the University of Chicago before 2000 and saying, I don't think we can trust these guys with the economy. This is in the world's most famous department of economics. And he was right, of course. And he realized the problem was ethics. And when I went to see him, I said, have your fellow Nobel laureates engaged with this discussion? He said, not at all. You're one of the first people to come and talk about it. I said, why did you write it? And he told me about the students, and then he told me a lovely thing about his wife. He said, I'm a secular Jew, born in New York, lived in Chicago. You don't get much more secular than that. 2 minutes left. I haven't started yet. Well, sort of. But he said, I did one very un-Jewish thing. I married a black Episcopalian lady. And she had taught his children virtue. And that's what he was proud of. That's our shortage. The thing that will matter for the younger generation is, who can I trust? Your list of people you can trust is going to be your lifeline. And of course, the students who take the Augustine course, the first thing they do is bond. And they make friends for life, people they can trust. Now, I'm going to go 2 minutes over because I need to set this up a little bit. The first and most important example of this, and we'll deal with it properly in the next session, is in fact reductionism. And it's nice to have it just at this level so that you can take a 5 minute break, talk to one another, go to the bathroom, talk to me if you want to. When I went to medical school, I was turned into a reductionist in weeks without knowing it. In fact, it had already started in high school. It wasn't very long before you start referring to patients not by their names but by their disease. That's reductionism in a very easily understood way. They are not to be reduced to their disease, they are people. But we do this in every area. We reduce things instead of recognizing the complexity, beauty, and profundity that God has put into them. Now, that reductionism was essential to the development of experimental science. That's the good part. It's when it spread from that it started to go wrong. Now, in the ancient world, when anyone wanted to give a causal account of something, they knew there were at least four categories that were necessary. They needed to know what the thing was made of, the material cause. They needed to know the ideas that were required, that's the formal cause. They needed skills that were needed and tools that were needed, that's the efficient cause. And they needed to have a purpose for doing it. Now, their world was a qualitative world. They were concerned about qualities more than quantities. And that world fitted in with the Christian world in many respects. And that went on for a long while. Only after Aquinas synthesized Greek learning with the scripture did things begin to change. Incidentally, it's worth knowing that Aquinas never finished the Summa. And the reason was that he had a vision of Christ some months before he died. In the chapel, another monk was there who just heard two sentences, one from Christ and one from Thomas. Christ said to Thomas, "It is well done, Thomas, what do you want?" And Thomas said, "Only you, O Lord." And he never wrote another word after that. When asked why he wasn't finishing the greatest intellectual feat in five centuries, he said, "It's all straw." The greatest human intellectual accomplishment in 500 years appeared to him to be straw after a brief interview with Christ, in which he was told he had done well. It's important to bear those things in mind. God gives us the dignity of causality. He has no needs. Nothing is going to fail because you didn't do it. God doesn't require anything from you. But you need to do the things that he puts in front of you, because in the process you will become more like him. That's the intent. So, like many evangelicals, the church was somewhat worried by what Thomas had done, because the university started around the same time and Aristotelian logic was dominating the philosophy program. And the Bishop of Paris in particular was worried that this might undermine the faith of the humble poor. And it might. And so temporarily, whilst the whole program was reviewed, Aristotelian deductive logic was forbidden. Oxford didn't take any notice, so they carried on and got a bit ahead of Paris. And of course, it was an impossible ban to maintain. It was soon shrugged aside. But everybody in the university was under the authority of the bishop. So at least initially, they had to obey. I imagine it went something like this. They all went off to the pub and got drunk first. I mean, what would you do if you were a professor and you had your notes taken away from you at the beginning of August and you had to teach at the end of August? You would not be a happy camper. And when they sobered up, this is pure artistic license on my part, but I imagine them saying, "Well, what are we going to do?" So we said, "Well, we haven't made much progress in science, have we really? And we just thought we were beginning." I said, "God told us we were supposed to be in charge of the world in many respects, but we have no power over nature, really." And then one of the others said, "Well, we can't do deductive logic, but we could do inductive logic." Aristotle knew about it, but he never trusted it. He didn't trust starting with the particulars and going to the general. He tried to go from God and get down to the particulars. It's too long a journey. We always get lost on the way. But you could only go the other way if you believe something. What's that? To believe that an experiment done in Blacksburg would give the same result as an experiment done in London, what must you believe? You must believe that under the surface chaos of life, there is law. Because God is a lawgiver and somebody who doesn't act arbitrarily. Without that belief, you would never do it. That's what I had to learn in Africa. Nutrition education cannot work in Africa because their explanation is evil spirits. When we take our machines to Africa, they don't work because machines stop because of evil spirits, not because you didn't put oil on them. Deeper, right at the heart of our culture is this trust that God is trustworthy. And that made inductive reasoning possible. It made it rational. It was a slow process. It was another nearly 100 years before the Merton College crowd got to the point of drawing the first graph and not knowing what they'd done. But they were beginning to think seriously. And major scholars that ought to be the heroes of our Christian children, they don't even know their names. People like Bradwardine and the like, Gross Tester and Swineshead. They're important people. And then the next century was in France with Nicole Oresme and Jean Buridan. Again, names that are not known by Christian young people. But in the middle of that was a man called William of Ockham, whose name you probably have heard in relation to Ockham's razor. But Ockham never actually wrote the razor. His stuff is a bit dense. He was a Franciscan too, and he had some understanding of what was happening in the world, intuitive understanding, and he actually wanted, I think, to protect God. It's something you should never do. God can look after himself quite easily. He doesn't need any help from you. But that's what Ockham did, and he saw that this science was going to be successful. He understood that what they were already doing in Merton College was going to make differences in the world. And it might undermine the faith. So what he tried to do is pull apart the world that we could do science on from the world that we couldn't do science on. And he called the bit that we can't do science on just names. Hence, reductionism was initially called, it came out of nominalism. So Ockham said, the only things we really understand are the things we can appreciate directly with our senses. And these are all capable of being measured, quantified. But we can't live without the others. It's a question you can ask of any student, any group of students anywhere in the world now, and you will get their attention immediately. I do this regularly, pretending that I've made a mistake, of course. I say, I haven't been in your university very long, just a few hours, but I know you all hate divorce. And you see the body language tighten up. He's being rude and unkind to divorcees. That's not acceptable, et cetera, et cetera. You can see the bubble over their heads. But I don't allow the bubble to burst. I say, I can see you're upset with me, but I think I can show you that you do hate divorce. If it hasn't happened to you, it has happened to your friends. There isn't a student in university today who hasn't had some reasonably intimate engagement with divorce. Has any child ever enjoyed it? That's a no-brainer, isn't it? No child has ever enjoyed it. They may ultimately come to see that it was inevitable, but they didn't enjoy it. So that's why you hate it. And in fact, it is the immaterial things, the divorce is an attack on, that matter to you most. And then I ask them to name the immaterial things that really matter. And with a little coaxing, they'll get to love, trust, honor, justice. They can't be measured. They're not quantifiable. And so they're being sidelined. And we need to point out, they're not less reliable, they're more reliable. The moral universe has been fixed from day one. It goes from truth to lies. Honor to dishonor, fidelity to infidelity. You see how it works. It's bipolar. The physical universe is not like that. We think it's expanding. We may or may not be right. The moral world has not changed from day one. Science changes all the while. And the fact that it works doesn't make it right. Ptolemy's model of the cosmos was wrong, but he had one of the longest runs, 1,500 years. So don't fix it because it ain't broke. It's not a good idea. You fix it when it's wrong. It may be working. Ptolemy's model worked for the calendar and predicting planetary eclipses and all that kind of thing. Copernicus's was not that much better, a little bit. But it was nearer the truth. Still had a way to go. And the world was changed by four men who believed in God, who gave us a tacitly atheistic world in which fact had changed from moral fact to physical fact. And that's where reductionism really begins to go badly wrong. And I'll leave you, a good thing for you to think about in the next 5 minutes. See if you can name some categories of life and church where that kind of reductionism has come in, where we are trying to have control over things that we should simply be in awe of. And it turns up in church on Sundays. See if you can find an example of reductionism in church. And it's in your kitchen. See if you can find one there. And we'll see where you've got to when we come back after a 5 minute break. And it was inevitable I went over, but they were listening, so it's all right. You came for some other things. Anybody think of reductionism in the church and reductionism in the kitchen? Yeah.
The church, come on. Measuring the health of a church based on attendance numbers.
That's reductionism, yeah. But it's even worse than that, you know. The way we present the gospel, particularly if you come down to the four spiritual laws, for instance. What we've done is have a checklist so that you can tick it off and sign here you're a Christian. Are you? You may be, but it's not because you signed that list. And I think we do much better at being in total wonderment at conversion. Because I would put it to you, there's not one person in this room who can look at their conversion and then fit it on someone else. Christ comes to us individually. It's amazing, but he does. And I maintain that we don't know how he does it. We have no... You see, what happened in this... blossoming at one level of reductionism is that we change from causal explanations to procedural explanations. That's what we do in modern science. We take something that's at a biological level and we turn it into a chemical level, and the chemical one into a physical one. And we call that explanation, but it's not. It's a procedural explanation. But for the ancient world, they wanted to know what things were for. Teleology cannot be measured, but we cannot live without it. So as somebody put it, you push Lady Teology out the front door and she'll come back in the back door. And God has his own ironic revenge, particularly in genetics. And the biologists are the most fervently anti-teleological people in the university. If you say something was designed in a first-year biology class, you'll be lucky to get an F. And yet they go back to their laboratory and they do precisely that. Because, of course, when DNA was first, at the first level, solved in 1953... Watson and Crick did not know what they'd got. And it was, in fact, a physicist who looked at the data and said, that's got to be a code. And it is. So at the heart of every cell in your body is a 2-meter stretch of DNA, which is a blueprint for the basic modeling of you and me, only the basic modeling. Now, that isn't a stunning thought. Now, I had this given to me in a particular way, and I'll tell you the story because I know many of you will use it, and that's what you should do. Because when God does something like that, it's worth noting. I've been to teach in Cuba at least half a dozen times. Initially, it was to teach medicine, but I also was allowed to talk to Christian doctors. And I was even allowed to preach as long as I didn't push the envelope too much. And on about the third trip, I had given a lecture on some aspect of medicine. I can't remember what it was. And a gentleman came up to me, and he turned out to be the head of Marxism and Leninism in the local university. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I've come to see you. And I said, why? And he said, well, the students tell me that you say that Russia rotted from the inside. It was not brought down by American economic power. It was brought down by internal rot. No one trusts anyone else in Russia. You can't run a big society on that basis. The only way you could run it, as Lenin wrote to a friend, when we have abolished God, it will be necessary to legalize terror. He was Jewish. He understood that man is a fallen creature. You've got to have some means of control. But the KGB was too expensive, and it was corrupt itself. So he said, when I saw that Russia was going to collapse and it was falling into the hands of the mafia, I didn't want that to happen to Cuba. We had enough of that with Batista before the revolution. They had, basically, it was a mafia-run island. They didn't want to go back to that. So he said, I stopped teaching Marxism and Leninism and I tried to teach multicultural ethics. But the students go to sleep. But they tell me they don't go to sleep when you teach ethics. So I want you to debate me tomorrow morning in front of the faculty on what is the nature of human ethics. Can it be, is it material or is it more than that? And I don't mind losing. Great guy. Well, there's no way I'd say no to that. So I had one evening to think about how I would do it. And then I knew that I'd got several starts that would work. I mean, it's like playing chess. But I knew there was a better way to do it, but I didn't know what it was. And the good Lord didn't tell me till I got up from my seat to walk from the front seat to the lectern. He changed the first 10 minutes in my head. Fortunately, I had a Canadian Columbian translator, because you can't trust Marxist translators. And I said, right on the blackboard behind me in Spanish, this message assembled itself. And he did. And then I asked the profs and the graduate students, if you'd come into the lecture room and found this on the board, what would you make of it? And they said, well, it's a sentence. This message assembled itself. But it's nonsense, because the whole point about messages is that they don't assemble themselves. And I said, quite right. And I turned around and crossed out the word message and put DNA in its place. And I said, but you do believe this sentence, this DNA, assembled itself. But don't you see, it's exactly the same sentence. DNA is not even a protein. It's not you and me. It's a blueprint. Not even written. It's a blueprint on how to make you and me. And the whole audience burst into applause. I'd won the debate, because they could see that I was going to take materialism as a basis of ethics apart. And that, by the way, is the way all our children should be taught to deal with evolution. You cannot get an individual ethic of altruism from a Darwinian model. It's impossible. Fortunately for us, the best person to make this case was Australia's best analytical philosopher and atheist, who committed suicide when he found he'd got cancer, a perfectly rational thing for an atheist to do, but not before he had written Darwinian Fairy Tales, a book that should be on your shelf and read. Darwinian Fairy Tales, David Stove. He says, I couldn't care less about how much evolution is involved in human development, but one thing is certain, it does not provide a means of explaining altruism. And that's what the book is about. And he writes beautifully with a tongue, with a pen dipped in a mixture of venom and elegance. Well worth reading. So that's the world that was faced back in 1953. That we had a blueprint, but nobody really thought their way through that. Crick was an atheist to the end of his life. But I say that I've lived from genetic fundamentalism to the modern day. Mendel was extremely lucky. If he'd chosen any other plant in the garden, it wouldn't have come out as a simple dominant recessive. He was very, very lucky indeed. And of course, we began to realize that. So when I was in medical school, cystic fibrosis was one gene, therefore one protein. Now, I don't know what the latest count is, but at least 30 subtypes would be my guess. Yes, there's a common single change which affects just one little zinc gate on a chloride channel, but changes around it also make a big difference. God is very good at origami. He likes shape. And reductionism says same molecule, same atomic structure, same function. No. We learned that a long while ago, because people working on different proteins, or so they thought, when they sent the structure at the level of amino acids in, they were told, you guys think you're working on leukocyte endogenous mediator, and you guys think you're working on pyrogen, but it has the same structure. Well, it doesn't have the same structure, it has the same atomic structure. But you change the charges, and you change the shape, and you get a different function. So now I think, the last time I checked up, we've got 30,000 different proteins from a single gene in a fruit fly. That's pretty amazing. And it's all epigenetic factors now. The way that by simply changing the pH a bit or putting a sugar here or whatever there, environmental change changes the shape, changes the function. And it gets even worse or better from our point of view. I was in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, so it's fresh in my mind because that's where it happened in the first place. And I've forgotten about the story for a while, but it's a lovely story. Somebody's already come up to me and talked about science not being the reductionistic thing that they would like it to be. And this is a good example. You know, or you should know, that God writes your description in a four-letter alphabet and only uses a three-letter word. If we make it digitally and call them 1, 2, 3, 4, you'll see why I'm doing that in a moment. Everything is read off in triplets. So one triplet will say start at the next letter. And then you peel off in triplets for about 1,000 and you've got a protein. So roughly, you need roughly 1,000 letters in order to get a protein. But what was discovered a few years ago, more than 20 years ago actually, every now and again we got our biochemical scissors so that we could snip up bits of DNA and think we got a gene and put it into a translation system, and every now and again we got two proteins. But it didn't seem as though we got enough messaging to get two proteins. And the guy who sorted it out, he didn't sort it out, he insists that God showed him, Christian, he was sitting in his lab in Seattle, well, a dozen or more years ago now, looking at his data where he'd got two proteins from a strip of DNA that looked as though it wasn't long enough. And God showed him. So, going in the trip, playing the triplet game. So he got 1, 2, 3, saying start at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, off in triplets for 1,000, and you've got a protein. Then he discovered there was another bit here that said, oh, by the way, you can start at 2, and go 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and on for 1,000, and you've got another entirely different protein, both of which function. God can overwrite without losing the message. There's no analogy for that in human terms. When Bill Gates was shown it, he said, we wouldn't even know how to begin trying to program that. It is absolutely stunning. So instead of it getting simpler, which is a requirement of simple Darwinism, it's become ultimately just absolutely stunningly impossible. This couldn't happen by chance. John Lennox has calculated the probabilities of being less than one for all the molecules in the universe. That's well past zero. There is a number for zero. So that's the world we live in. The reductionistic world is being taken apart at the far end, in the modern age, so that in cosmology and quantum physics, people have been talking about design for years now, and nobody bothers, because how else would you talk about it? As Robert Spitzer brilliantly puts it, there's lots of room for prayer in quantum physics, because you can think about it as particle or wave, and it will behave like whichever instrument you use. So if you use a wave detector, lo and behold, it behaves like a wave. Use a particle detector, it behaves like a particle, but a very special particle, because it can produce an interference pattern. So one particle knows what another... Oh, I give up at this point, don't you? But that's God's world. I mean, what it means is we simply don't have the metaphors. The mathematics always works, but we don't have the metaphors. Calling it a wavicle doesn't solve the problem, you know. And everybody in quantum physics knows that. So God is a common source of conversation there. In fact, I heard one guy say, if I meet somebody saying they're doing quantum physics and they're not thinking about God, I don't think they're doing quantum physics. So it's physics that has the highest prevalence of real believers in the university. It will be followed shortly by molecular biology, which will really, really hurt some of the biologists, but they're going to have to deal with it. That's the world we live in. Reductionism, yes, it took us all this way, but now you get to the far end and you come back to the beginning again. But it worked to begin with. So within, once this revolution had occurred, so it went from Occam, then Descartes picked it up. I think, therefore, I am. Yeah, it's not a very smart move. It doesn't really work. Then Francis Bacon said, collect facts, and he had changed the meaning of the word fact. For the ancient world, moral facts were reliable, physical facts were not. In our world, we like to believe that physical facts are reliable and moral facts are not. We're wrong. It's the other way around. So that was important because Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton advanced cosmology dramatically in a century, and it was happening everywhere. At the same time, the Catholic Church had screwed up over its handling of Galileo. And by the way, do you know which verse it was in the Bible that really caused the trouble? Being biblicist people, you ought to know that. Yeah, but which verse in the Bible was it that mattered most? No, it's the Psalms. The earth is fixed and cannot be moved forever. Now, if you don't recognize the Psalms as a poetry book, you're in trouble, aren't you? Try to use it as a physics textbook and you're in trouble. Galileo put it beautifully. He said, the Bible tells us how to go to heaven. Physics tells us how the heavens go. It's a nice aphorism. And it was true. And it took a long while to sort out. But Galileo, Kepler, and Newton changed our world and gave us a mechanical model. Now, Newton was a smart Christian, a very odd one, but very thoughtful. And he said, I feel at the end of my life that I'm like a little boy who's been on the seashore picking up pebbles, looking at them, and casting them away for another. That was the way he summarized the greatest intellectual feat by a single author in the history of science. And it will never be repeated at that scale. Newtonians thought he got it right. He said, I feign no hypotheses. And all that he wanted was that his work should bring people to God. That's not usually mentioned by people like Dawkins. And we don't know it because we don't read. So within 100 years of Newton, Napoleon famously asked Laplace, where does God fit in your science? And Laplace, a practicing Catholic, says, Sire, I have no need of the hypothesis of God to do science. And that was true. Once the methodology had been developed, you could do science very easily by simply obeying the rules. Scientific papers often have logical errors in, but the methodology is repeatable, and that's where the strength lies. But it can take 10 years to sort out the errors. It's worth knowing that. But the major steps forward are not achieved by that way. That gives what I call piled higher and deeper type science, PhD science. The leading edge stuff is quite different. And when you're at a conference with people doing on the edge, you don't hear the words that you read in the ultimate papers. You hear words like elegance, cool, because they're fairly challenged in their vocabulary. But beauty is even mentioned. Einstein famously felt his equations. And then there was a great deal of work to do to find out whether his feelings were justified. He tried to do it the reductive way, and it wouldn't work. He just got lost in all the possibilities. He knew what the right answer was, and then he went for it and published it. And Planck, fortunately, read the papers and said they should be published, and he was right. Despite the fact that another guy came along and did an experiment which allegedly disproved it, and Einstein said there's something wrong with the experiment, and there was. He hadn't calibrated his machinery properly, and it took 10 years to sort out. But these two things are there in leading-edge science. This recognition that God is at the heart of it is a good thing, not a bad thing. The father of modern botany is a man called John Ray. Most people have never read about, but you should read about him. An astonishing Puritan. Linnaeus thought he was wonderful. We don't know enough history, that's the bottom line. And reductionism in the gospel, to come back to that starting point, is yes, once you become a Christian, I can start asking you questions. Okay, have you read this? What do you think Paul meant in Romans, whatever? That can be done in a way that you can discuss academically. But Christ calls us to bear witness, doesn't he? And most of you, like me, have very bad days as a Christian, right? Your witness on those very bad days is that this is a very bad day. And any other witness is false witness, which you're not supposed to do. And of course, if you're running a laboratory, for instance, you say, you better leave me alone today, I'm not in a good mood. And they can quite rightly say, you're supposed to be a Christian. Yes, I am, but this doesn't sound much like Christianity. I agree, it isn't. But you think I hold on to my faith. You've got it the wrong way around. My faith holds on to me. I'll be better tomorrow, hopefully. I mean, my children will never forget one Sunday where Sally and I had a flaming row after church. She's a redhead, so we had rows regularly. It was always her fault. And then she said, you better say grace. And I said, I can't say grace. And the children sat at the table. Dad was not going to say grace. I said, I can't. It was the worst meal we'd had. Children left in tears. They never forgot it, though. The honesty that you need to be straight with God before you pretend to thank him when you're in a mood like that. You've got to hope that he doesn't end the world immediately. Honesty works. It's impressive in a way that's quite stunning to people. And they, over the years, they realize that. Now, I mustn't digress. I've already been told off by Ross once for digressing too much, and I easily digress on that. But just think about that in church, that where we can use, if you like, the quantitative approach is, have you read your Bible this week? What serious progress have you made? Can you answer the following questions as a Christian? But when it comes to how you became a Christian, tell the story like it was. Lewis is a very good example. He goes from atheism to theism rationally, which I think is easier to do now than it was then. But when it comes to becoming a Christian, he says, I didn't know what to do with Jesus. He went and watched the wallabies jumping around in the bluebells, and then he knew that Jesus was the Son of God. And he doesn't tell you how he knew that, because he didn't know. He's honest. I was once involved in a project, it's still in publication, I think, by IVP, called Professors Who Believe. 22 professors who were bullied into writing down their faith stories by John Anderson from Minnesota. I'm glad he did it. I resisted, but in the end I did it. And when I got the book, I was delighted, because there was only one story I'd leave out, because I think in many of our evangelical churches, we encourage or bully teenagers into having a conversion, right? Or having the sort of story you're supposed to tell in our church. The real thing is so much more interesting and so much less of an explanation. Some of you have a moment of truth, which happened to my wife, and it's hilarious in a sense. God knew what he was doing way ahead of time, because if there's anybody who shouldn't have got converted at a Billy Graham crusade, it's my wife. But that's when it happened, when she was a teenager. Not even the real thing, just an audio relay in the church. And she knew that it happened because the day before she'd been disrupting the scripture class in school, and she woke up the next morning and she wanted to read the Bible. That had never happened before. That's convincing, and it's real. It's not explanatory. It's just a story, but it's an extraordinary one. I don't have a moment of conversion that I can remember. I was always given my grandfatherly Marxism. I always knew that Christianity made nicer people than Marxism did, and that Marxism didn't explain any of the difficult questions. So I was won by Pascal's wager immediately I heard of it. It doesn't make you a Christian, but it does make you realize that's most likely to be the true story. And mine was a long, slow burn as God made me. He made me as a certain sort of person who had to think their way through things and realize, okay, this is where I've got to. My favorite example of this phenomenon, and I can't resist putting this in, is a friend of mine who last summer completed a 25-year journey to faith, on which journey I have accompanied him. We met for the first time 25 years ago. I gave a lecture in Ottawa. He's a journalist, a man called John Robson. You can find him at the National Post. Very good journalist. And he was sent to report on a talk I gave called Why Are There No Hittites on the Streets of New York? A talk I still have to give endlessly. As he left, he said to another journalist, the only Christian journalist I know in Ottawa, I enjoyed that, didn't expect to. And she said, would you like to meet him? He said, yes, as long as he doesn't know that. She said, I can arrange that, and she did. And we became friends. We used to meet every few months and have lunch together and argue. He was an atheist, PhD in history, speaks three languages. I was the other side of the equation. But we liked arguing. And about 6 years or so into this experience, he wrote a piece in the newspaper. And I happened to buy the newspaper that day, and I couldn't believe it. It was called Why Taking the Cross Seriously Can Make You Very Cross. Lovely title. And it began roughly like this, paraphrasing it. He said, the Eastern Mediterranean at the time of Christ was not an ignorant backwater, but where Greek learning, Roman pragmatism, and Jewish theology met, some fishermen, a tax collector, and a man who had a seizure on the road to Damascus persuaded their neighbors and then the whole Roman Empire that a dead Jewish carpenter was God. How weird is that? Isn't that a lovely pre-evangelism sentence? He went on, he said, and this God didn't prance around in power, but he allowed his creatures to nail him to a stick on a dunghill, and that changed the history of the world. How weird is that? He understood that the world changed after Christ. Historically, he said, it's undeniable. All sorts of things changed within the next century and a half. And he said, I, as an atheist, have to acknowledge that people like Augustine, Aquinas, and C.S. Lewis, of whom he'd read everything now after I'd introduced him, were not stupid. So if I'm going to be an honest atheist, I must read the scriptures seriously, but I'm mortally afraid that if I do, the monk will win the argument. I immediately sent him an email saying, John, I wish I'd written that piece. It was 3 times that length. And he said, you wrote one sentence, but you promised me I could talk to you when I needed to. I think I need to talk to you. I said, you do. And we met at the pub that night. My wife was away somewhere, I don't know where. And so there was no cook at home. So he arrived from his karate class. He's a black belt too. And I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I'm not an atheist anymore. I'm a theist. I believe there's a mind behind the universe. But what do I do with Jesus? No, not being a good evangelical. I said, you don't expect me to answer that question, do you? This is far too much fun to watch. I knew that he knew what he had to do. And it was going to take longer than I expected. The next thing was about another 10 years or so. He called me and said, my common law wife and I now both believe in God. Now, his wife hated me before that, but she'd got past that stage. And we think we ought to get married. Can you find a priest who will marry us, although we don't yet believe in Jesus? I said, yeah, I can do that. So I did that. The ceremony had John, his wife, the priest, and somebody dragged off the street as a witness. That was it. It was over in 15 minutes. But they were married. Then about 2 years ago, I asked him to do a session on Magna Carta at the summer program that we run, which he did very well. And I asked him before the beginning, where have you got to? I hadn't seen him for about a year. He said, still the same. I knew he wasn't because I'd been watching his writing and I could see there was a change in tone going on. And this last summer, he said, I'm a Christian now, and it's time I said so. Times are getting darker, and he says so in print now. 25 years, but what a lovely communication. He doesn't know how it happened, but he knows that it has happened. And that's the important thing about our faith. We know with a certainty that we know about virtually nothing else that we do believe. And that is not changed by circumstance. That's reality. And that's what we need to bear witness to. And I say to non-Christian colleagues who meet me now and from my days as a trendy scientist, and they will say things like, in a university your mugshot appears, so they turn up, they've got nothing better to do, and if they're British they'll be rude. And say things like, oh, I haven't seen you for years. No, don't go to the meetings where we used to meet anymore. They say, no, I used to read your stuff till the mid-90s. The clear implication being that I lost my mind in the mid-90s. And so I say to them, you think I lost it? And they say, well, you write rubbish now, don't you? And I say, well, I think I can prove you're wrong. And they look at me and say, well, what do you call somebody who's lost their mind? And of course, the answer is mad. What happens to their life? It falls apart. Well, you can ask my wife, and she's not on my side, but she'll tell you, life has got better, not worse. So my life has not fallen apart, it's fallen together. But I'm now not doing science because there are more important things to do. Your problem is that you've bought a pup. You think that post-endarkment rationality, I won't call it enlightenment because it wasn't, is a complete description. It's not, it's a subset. There's plenty of space within my faith for the practice of reductionistic science, but not the other way around. Which is the bigger box? That's a no-brainer. The other thing that the young people here, and many of you don't know, is who you should be able to refer to in any given specialty as examples. I'll just give you one example and tell you the story of a man whose name you all know, or if you don't, your education has been totally neglected. And you can raise your hand when you know who it is, but I'm going to tell you the story in a way that it doesn't occur in the textbook. He was born in London to a very poor family. His father was a blacksmith. What education he had was in the church, where he was many times per week, and that's where he learned to read, write, and think. By the time he was 11 or 12, he was already working as an apprentice bookbinder in London. Fortunately, he had a good boss who realized this was not your ordinary bookbinder, and he said, look, you can read those books as well. And he started reading the books he was binding, a lot of science, became very interested in it. So he started going to the free public lectures at the Royal Institute and the Royal Society. He took excellent notes. By the time he was about 15 or so, he knew he didn't want to spend his life binding books. What he really wanted to be, in our terms, was the lab tech who set up the experiments to go with the lectures at the Royal Institute. So he bound his treasured notes beautifully, which he could do, and then trusted them and sent them to the president of the Royal Institute and asked for the job that he wanted. With a few hiccups, he got it. Very shortly, he became indispensable, because what impressed the boss was not just the quality of the notes, but his ideas about what the next experiment should be. And he started to be introduced to all the famous scientists of the day. So all around Europe, they knew there was a young man in London who'd never been to high school, who was very smart. Eventually, he became president of the Royal Institute. He turned down the Royal Society twice on the grounds he was too busy. And he was known to stop the committee meetings at the Royal Institute so that he could get to his prayer meeting. Who is he? No, that's it. Sorry? I heard somebody say it, I think. That's right. It was Michael Faraday. Now, if that introduced the unit on electricity in high school, it might sort of undermine the anti-Christian stuff, mightn't it? They laughed at Mr. Faraday's fields, but now you switch them on every day, every 5 minutes. We don't know our own heroes, and that's a disaster. So in the history of science course that I teach, one of the things I want them to go away with is a list of heroes and the odd heroine in science. Hopefully that will change. I don't know. That's in God's hands, not ours. But that's what you need to understand. And the reductionism of science is good for science, but the moment it comes into morality and religion and other areas in the kitchen, God made food, not nutrition. They're very different. Nutrition is a reductive exercise, often wrong. Food is not. Eat to appetite from a variety of sources. You need no supplements and you need not worry. And if you never eat alone, if you have a weight problem, that will be under control too. Because if you, as my wife would insist, when you sit down to the meal of the day, and everybody better be there, you have some decent table manners, use a knife and fork, put them down between mouthfuls and make a civilized comment, you're going to take an hour over the meal. That's long enough to switch off your out-of-control appetite and control your body weight. That's the way it works. The dining room table is the center of a Jewish family, and it's why the Jews succeed. Now, that's as far as I'm going to be able to go because I've got 5 minutes left. I got Q&A, but she's waving her hand. Relativism, I'll pick up again tomorrow because the other things flow. You get reductionism right, and the other ones come forward. If you want to an easy introduction to relativism, there are two books that are worth getting your hands on. One is Peter Kreeft's The Reduction of Moral Relativism, K-R-E-E-F-T, published by Ignatius Press. He has a brilliant teaching tool. He writes dialogues, and this one, he usually writes dialogues between Socrates and a modern person, but this one is brilliant. It's between a sassy black American feminist and a Muslim scholar. That's very clever because it takes the anti-Christian biases out of the discussion. And of course, the Muslim scholar is a moral objectivist. They believe that moral truth is an objective reality. The sassy black American feminist doesn't. And her world gets taken apart by the Muslim. That's clever. There's one for students in which he uses Socrates, and that's in a book called Life is a Miracle. And all the students need is the last chapter, written as a dialogue. If you've got two actors in your church, they could put it on as a skit. It's funny, it's clever, and all the points that need to be made are pretty well made in 35 pages of double-spaced dialogue. So not a big deal. And he doesn't mind you photocopying it. I checked with him. He said, if it's for the kingdom, I don't care. So the key giveaway line in our world, and one that we haven't recognized even in the church, I tried to get James Dobson to change and he wouldn't, but values language. You see, the problem with values is that it's intrinsically relativistic. I try never to use the values language. It came from Nietzsche, after all, and He didn't bring us good things. When you say my values are, the other person says my values are. You've set up relativism immediately. But if you ask what is the truth about the world, you have an entirely different discussion. Worldviews are also relativistic. They're very common, especially amongst evangelicals, but it's much better to reverse the word order and talk about the truth about the world. Because now you're assuming that there is a truth to be known and they have to prove there isn't. That's very difficult to do. But once you say worldview, they say, you have yours, I have mine. Quits. You've given the argument away before you start. So be more careful with the language you use. This process that I was talking about, the change, moral objectivity being replaced by moral subjectivity, basically Hume, who is much loved by the liberals, and we don't even know how to take him apart in most cases, got it wrong. He was a Scottish philosopher who liked to go to church because he liked to watch people believing, although he didn't believe himself. But he famously said, when you see something wrong, like murder, and you examine it from all directions, you find nothing wrong till you examine your own heart. There you find a feeling of disapprobation. It's not in the thing, it's in your heart. It's subjective. That, of course, is not true. But they like that, so it's taught in school all the while. You must be able to take your Hume apart. Real truth exists. And we all know it. We know when we are loved and when we are hated. Nobody likes being lied to. Infidelity is really painful. You know, these things happen. They're real. And we need to make the case. And do it by questions. The fundamental reflex of the modern student who's a Christian must be, don't make statements, ask questions. I tell them, put it on your fridge. So the last thing you see when you go out in the morning is, don't make statements, ask questions. And if you don't know what the question is, help is a prayer that's usually answered instantly. It's amazing. It's a very, very good prayer. So the real question is not whether truth exists, but how far we can know it. And we've got to come to Q&A. So I'm going to allow you to take over at this point. And those that wish to leave or have other duties, just go. I mean, I'm a professor. I'm not the least bit bothered whether you stay or go. You know, I won't lose sleep or anything like that. If I was left on my own, that's fine. If you go to sleep, I can, you know, walk out quietly and not disturb your slumber, you know. But are there any questions?